Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll speak with Heather Digby Parton about our long national nightmare now in its 167th day. Seems long. Then we'll be joined by David Dayen to talk about a huge rift on the left that followed the death for now of a single-payer bill in California. Dayen wrote about that this week for The Intercept. First, a few items you may have missed. Canada is poised to become the first country to legalize the recreational use of marijuana nationwide. They may apologize for that because they tend to apologize well. But Josh Wingrove and Jen Skerritt report for Bloomberg that, quote, the biggest challenge for Justin Trudeau's forthcoming legal recreational marijuana market is a shortage of pot. So the goal of the law is to wipe out the black market and deprive criminals of revenues from selling weed, which makes a hell of a lot of sense if you ask me. But officials worry that inadequate supplies of pot through legal channels will keep at least a portion of that black market alive. The problem, the core problem, appears to be that Canadians really like their weed. So that's happening. A Russian official who earns $75,000 per year and whose business partner is a Russian intelligence operative has bought up about $8 million worth of Trump-branded condos in Florida, according to Lily Dobrovolskaya and Nicholas Nihamas at the Miami Herald. With apologies to Lily for mangling her last name. We should note that these were resales, so those revenues are not going to Donald Trump's companies. It just certainly seems that some sort of sketchy business is going on in the Sunshine State having to do with Trump-branded properties and the Russians. After 8 years of spewing nonsense about how Obama was coming for your guns, produced, you know, robust gun sales. The firearms business is down by 10% since Obama left the White House. But the NRA has an answer, several answers, actually. George Zornick, my colleague at The Nation, writes that the gun industry is increasingly marketing its wares to women and children because the traditional, you know, marketed to men segment of the market has become saturated. He writes, and I quote, new lines of weapons designed for young shooters have been rolling off the production lines, like the Cricket Company's David Cricket rifle and other 22 caliber long guns, which often come in bright primary colors. Nice, cheery, and are designed with plastic parts to make them lighter and produce less recoil. Shooting sports retailer enthused that these weapons bring the coolness and fun of the tactical rifle to kids and less serious shooters. The NRA also has a family branding arm that promotes guns to children on its website, including in the 6 to 12-year-old range. So that's one way that they're looking to compensate for losing the scary black guy in the White House. And then there's that new apocalyptic ad you've probably heard about. This is right-wing lunatic Dana Loesch narrating.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage.
Okay, enough of that. Bill Moyers and Michael Winship rightly called this, quote, a call for white supremacy and armed insurrection. Each word and image deliberately chosen to stir the feral instincts of troubled souls who lash out in anger and fear. Good turn of phrase, guys. But Dana Loesch doubled down, saying, how does criticizing violence incite violence? And this is a theme that you're getting from the right all the time, that, you know, the left is violent rhetoric. Of course, this follows the real act of violence by James Hodgkinson against a group of Republicans practicing for a baseball game a couple of weeks ago. The thing is that kind of violence from the left is exceedingly rare. It was the first serious act of left-wing violence since 2012. This is all pure projection. I had a piece at The Nation last week titled, "Why Does the Far Right Hold a Near Monopoly on Political Violence?" And in that piece, I noted that there was quite a bit of left-wing violence in the 1960s and 70s. But since the 1980s, for the last almost 40 years, almost all serious acts of political violence came from the fringes of the far right. And that's according to multiple experts and multiple databases, and we'll have one of those experts on next week. But what they do is they conflate like black bloc protesters, Antifa protesters, breaking windows, doing property damage with violence. And they do throw punches, right? These people are there. There is this dance that the so-called alt-right white nationalists and the Antifa protesters have where they get together and they know that they're going to fight. I limited my piece to serious violence, shootings and stabbings. And I will point out that over the last 18 months, there have been two acts of serious violence at protests. Both were by right-wingers who premeditatedly, who planned to go to a protest and shoot liberal protesters, and then did go to a protest and shoot liberal protesters. One was at a Black Lives Matter protest in Minnesota, following the shooting death of Philando Castile, and the other was at the University of Washington, where a couple basically set up a premise where he would shoot tear gas at a group of people, then they would come at him and she would shoot them, and that's exactly what happened. Finally, Joe Robertson reports for the Kansas City Star, and I quote, "If he could do it again, Missouri State Rep. Mike Moon figures he'd find another way to express his dismay with Missouri's legislative process than beheading and processing a chicken on camera." "I was just frustrated," the Ash Grove Republican told the Star. A Change.org petition called the video frightening and sociopathic. Moon says he only meant to show himself at work doing chores of his farm. He had 50 chickens to process on that Monday earlier in June. He didn't like it. He was frustrated with the so-called career politicians. He said, quote, "I do have a job outside of the legislature. My intent was to take a jab at the government." Anyway, with that bit of weirdness, we'll take a quick break and then be right back. Stay tuned.
Don't be scared. Stop acting weird. Soon we shall meet on our street. Music is sweet, man, I caught your beat. You heard the news, old pal, now don't run away.
Oh, sweet pea,
rocking down Orange Street.
Oh, sweet pea,
shaking up Orange Street.
Oh, sweet pea,
I'm coming in peace with my face to the east. Don't get upset, you live to regret. You must show me respect, and don't you forget, like a fish in the sea, you're caught in my net.
My hip now. Oh, sweet
Orange Street.
Whoa, sweet bee.
Rocking down Orange Street.
Whoa, sweet bee.
Upsetting the stomach.
Welcome back to the show. I am still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by one of our favorite guests, our favorite regular guest, Heather Digby Parton. You know her from her own blog, of course, at Hullabaloo, and she's also a columnist at Salon. Heather, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
What fresh hell have we this week? You know, we've been focusing so much attention on healthcare, rightly, and then also being distracted by shiny objects like the Morning Joe crew. But in the meantime, there appears to be an extremely serious threat to our democracy underway. And we've talked before in past segments about how, in a sense, we're fortunate that this White House is so bumbling and incompetent and doesn't have strong ties to the Republican Party, doesn't have a lot of loyalty among Congress. But Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas and the co-chair of Donald Trump's so-called Election Integrity Commission, is he a bumbling, inept person? Do you read him that way?
Well, no. What he is an extremist, and so he will push the limits as far as they'll go. And every time he pushes them, they don't exactly bounce back. I mean, he often goes, you know, runs right up against the courts. I mean, he was the architect of what was it, AB 17? Sorry, I can't remember specifically what it was. The Arizona law that was the showing the papers law.
Yeah, HB 1070.
HB 1070. Sorry. Yes, and he was the architect of that. And in fact, he wrote all those laws, those anti-immigration laws.
The Georgia one as well, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
He wrote the template for that. I mean, he's an anti-immigration zealot. This is his, you know, he has two things: voting, vote suppression, and anti-immigration. And I think you can
but
kind of figure out how
doing.
Those two things
I mean,
go. What he does,
this
he,
is the
he,
thing.
He's
he knows
a,
he's
what he's
doing.
He
is a smart lawyer, a dangerous ideologue, and I would say a genuine racist.
Yes, there's no doubt.
Person, right? I mean,
no doubt.
Okay, so I want to play you a brief clip from last night's Rachel Maddow show. This is Cheryl Ifill, the head of NAACP's, oh gosh, what is it? It's their litigation division, basically. Let's listen to this clip about what he might have in store, and then we'll come right back.
Thank you, Rachel.
So you were very clear about the connection between the president demanding information, demanding an investigation into the threat of voter fraud, and the possibility of the president then launching a voter intimidation effort. What's the connection between looking into it and then intimidating voters?
Well, as you talked about already, Rachel, the president had insisted that he had won the popular vote. And as you recall, he talked about 3 million illegal votes having been cast. And having gone out and kind of made this absurd statement, he then began to repeat it. And some of his surrogates began to repeat it, notably Stephen Miller on a Sunday morning news program, who insisted that there was proof of this. And I was just one of the people who took the president at his word because I believed that the president would attempt to combine his need to believe that he had won the popular vote with something that has been really a very important issue on the right, which is to prove that widespread voter fraud occurs as a justification for voter suppression. That's what we see in all the states where we're challenging voter ID laws, is that you have, you know, governors and secretaries of state and other state officials who insist, despite the fact that there's no evidence that this is true, that there is widespread in-person voter fraud happening, and that's the reason that they enacted some of these very, very restrictive voter ID laws. As you know, however, just in the last year, two federal courts of appeals neither one of them known for being particularly liberal, have found that at least two states, North Carolina and Texas, deliberately created their voter ID laws for the purpose of discriminating against minority voters, not because there was a voter fraud problem in the state. And so I think the president has really married his personal issue around the popular vote in this election to one of the pillars of the right, which is proving that there is widespread voter fraud, and using that premise to engage in voter suppression and to intimidate voters. And I think that's what we're about to see begin.
What do you think they want to do with this nationwide list? I mean, they're talking about collecting, you know, tens of millions, 100 million, 200 million voter data files here, basically, and consolidating them all in what they say, at least they tell reporters, will be a secure database.
Well, I think there are lots of people that are affiliated with people like Kris Kobach who know what they want to do with this information, organizations like True the Vote and others. They want to be able to use this data to be able to intimidate people on election day. They want to be able to use this data to convince state legislatures that there is a problem and that they need even more restrictive voter ID laws. They want to use this information to intimidate individual voters and to suggest to voters that if they try and vote, they may be prosecuted. I mean, we should remember the context in which this happens at this particular moment. The Attorney General of the United States is Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions is the man who prosecuted our clients in 1985 for voter fraud, unsuccessfully prosecuted them. And so he's been on top of this for a very long time as well. And even though that effort that Jeff Sessions engaged in 1985 was unsuccessful, our clients were acquitted, many voters in that county, in Perry County, Alabama, elderly voters were afraid to vote after that. They were afraid to vote after the attempted prosecution, and so they stayed away from the polls.
So that's pretty pretty terrifying, huh?
Well, yeah, and you know, I mean, this is the fact that you've got this combination. It's very lethal between Kris Kobach doing this commission and Jeff Sessions being in the Attorney General of the United States. That combination is a very, very dangerous thing. Both of those people are actually quite good, and they actually know how to manipulate the bureaucracy in order to get what they want, unlike Trump, who is, you know, operating on a completely different level. And most people
right.
in the White House, these are actual competent government bureaucrats when they put their minds to it. So that is a very, very dangerous thing. And, you know, it's interesting that the person on that out there mentioned Sessions, that lawsuit back in 1985, because that's when this whole thing really took off. I mean, they've been suppressing, Republicans have been trying to suppress the votes of minorities, shouldn't say Republicans, conservatives, forever. I mean, going back to Jim Crow, right? I mean, this is what they do. But in the 1960s, they were doing it, we had a Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist, who almost didn't make it onto the court because of evidence that he had been suppressing the vote in Arizona. He was a part of a group called Operation Eagle Eye, where they were going and kind of bad-vibing people who they thought looked like Mexicans out of going to the vote, going into the ballot box. So this is, you know, this is an old story, but in the mid-80s, when Sessions was doing that, this was right on the heels of a very, very big event, which was Jesse Jackson's presidential campaign. And that's really what started this modern vote suppression movement. Jackson proved that he could motivate a lot of African Americans, and the right went crazy. And they started to create this infrastructure, which has now kind of come into full fruition, with people, a whole generation who's been raised on this. But this is, you know, this has been a big deal. And they, I remember reading a thing by Donna Brazile, who was Jesse Jackson's campaign manager in 1988. And, you know, she was saying that was the moment at which they started creating things like the Republican National Lawyers Association. One of the main, this is a vote suppression outfit that's been around for decades now. And one of the fellows that's just been assigned to this new commission of Donald Trump's, a man by the name of Hans von Spakovsky, was a principal in that group. I mean, he's been doing this since at least since the 1990s. And this has been going on for many years. And now that they've got this commission, it really looks as though, and they have the power with a full-fledged, well, in my view, white supremacist, Jeff Sessions, as an attorney general, they're going to get some of this stuff done, and it's going to be very, very, I think they've determined they can't win elections legitimately, so they have to do this. This is the only way.
Well, this is a really key point. You talked about Jesse Jackson's candidacy. That was in the 80s. For the last 10 years or so, there has been this dominant narrative that the demographic headwinds are against them, that we're becoming a so-called minority-majority country, which is not true, but that's a subject for another show. And that, I think, has amped up all of these efforts, turned them up to 11, as they say. And I would note that this week, even as Kris Kobach was doing his, was seeking to get 50 states to submit to him a set of voter information, or information on basically 200 million voters. At the same time, the Department of Justice sent out requests for a variety of information about how states control their voter rolls. Kris Kobach, of course, created a system called CrossCheck, which checks registration, double checks that people are not registered in different places to vote. There are some on the left who paint this as a discriminatory tool, as a voter disenfranchisement tool against Democrats specifically. The data doesn't show that it flags more Democrats than Republicans, but what it does is it has a huge amount of false positives. And what this does is it feeds into this narrative that there's all these illegal voting, because you have these morons on Fox News, the moron in chief in the White House, that conflates registered people with people who vote. So, you know, they talk about dead people being registered as if those dead people are voting. They talk about people being registered in two places as if they are voting in two places, et cetera, et cetera. So if he, into the degree that he would put these names through CrossCheck, we don't really know for sure what they want to use it for. Eiffel says that they want to give it to these outside voter intimidation groups. But to the degree that they do that, he's going to be able to say we have X million people registered in two places, X million. He also wants to check it against an immigration database that has many flaws, also many flaws, which will discriminate, likely discriminate against groups that skew Democratic, because you get one Jose Garcia, you know, if you have, if you don't have a social security number or date of birth, that's going to show up false positives up the yin yang. And it's all really, really frightening stuff. And I would point out that, you know, we have an authoritarian in the White House, but we're not an authoritarian country as long as we have a free press and the ability to replace, you know, bad politicians at the ballot box. And I think that is imperiled. And I would just note that the backdrop to all of this is that the AP came out with an analysis last week. It found that Republicans, because of partisan gerrymandering, have as many as 22 additional House seats. The Republicans right now have this very, very significant congressional majority. They won the congressional popular vote by like half of a percentage point or something like that. And yet they have, you know, 56% of the seats, something on those lines. Don't quote my exact numbers, but the point is that it's disproportionate to the vote. And you see all this excitement on the left. But, you know, the wonks say that the Democrats need to win by about 8 percentage points, the popular vote by about 8 percentage points, to have a chance to take the House.
I mean, how can that be Democrats? how does that translate into what we understand to be, you know, a Democratic system? I mean, there's something.
I mean, you know, you have this president with 3 million fewer votes. The Senate has, like, the Republicans in the Senate have, I think, 20 million fewer votes cumulatively. It's really frustrating. Let me ask you this, Heather. We have seen such animation about health care. You know, you threaten to take my health care away, I'm going to get in the streets, I'm going to go and dog you at events. But it seems like this stuff, which is really fundamental, does not get the same kind of attention. And we've got about 90 seconds. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think I understand that in a way people are sort of afraid to start questioning the integrity of the voting system. There's a certain, I mean, even I have had this thought myself, you know, the more you talk about this, the less it seems that anybody can be seen as legitimate, right? I mean, it's just the legitimacy of our system is truly called into question on all counts. And you can see it being deployed on both sides, right? I mean, this could happen that nobody believes that there's any legitimacy to anyone who's elected anymore. I just kind of feel like that ship has sailed. I mean, I think at this point there's enough evidence, whether it's this vote suppression or whether this emerging evidence about manipulation by foreign agents into our system, the fact that one party seems to be relying on sort of undemocratic means to maintain power, all of this, I mean, it's been happening over and over again, right, going back to 2000. Where we had a dubious election result with the presidency. It has to be confronted at this point. So, you know, I feel like this is just going to take some effort on the part of people with credibility on the issue to stand up and just start talking about it and saying, this is really happening. We have to do something. And maybe the fact that Donald Trump won the way he won may actually be the thing that finally catalyzes that and gets people, you know, taking it seriously. Hopefully.
I really hope so. Heather Parton, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us this week. I really do appreciate it. I always like talking to you.
Oh, me too. Thanks for having me, Joshua. It was fun.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then be right back with David Dayan.
Must have been stoned when this whole thing started, 'cause I just can't seem to think straight anymore. Can't figure out where I'm at. Maybe Memphis, maybe Mexico. Think you're swell, but I ain't gonna tell you so. Thank you, great, but it's late, not better go. Hitchhike to Rome, take a Greyhound to Fredericksburg. Well, I'm flat out broke, I've been smoking butts for days. You say maybe you can stay with me, I say, lady, that's a dangerous plan. Quite a woman, but I don't wanna be your man. You're quite a kisser, but listen close and understand. Your hair. Won't you stay? I can play like I don't care. I think you're dope and I hope I'm making myself clear. I think you're flying, that's why I'm getting out of here. Well, I must have been stoned. Well, I must have been stoned.
Welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by David Dayan. David writes all over the place, including at The Intercept and The New Republic. David, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. Now, California Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon has been the recipient of a blizzard of hatred, including some threats. I wish I could report that this is the work of the alt-right or Breitbart readers or whatever. I am sorry to say, however, that this is the result of some on the left who are trying to pass a kind of symbolic piece of legislation, a bill that would ostensibly bring single-payer health care to the Golden State. And I was griping about this, and David said he had a piece dropping on Friday, so I invited him on. He was gracious enough to offer us some time. David Dayan's piece is at The Intercept. That's theintercept.com, all one word. It's titled, California Single-Payer Organizers Are Deceiving Their Supporters. It's time to stop. David, let me ask you this. If you were an emperor for a day, if you were a king for a day, you had no political constraints, there weren't legal issues, would you implement a so-called single-payer system which guarantees essential health care for all and pays for it through tax revenues?
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
I would do it tomorrow. Sure.
So that's your ideological position, right?
Absolutely.
So having Absolutely. Established that.
And in fact, I would say that it is because of my desire to do this and my belief that with hard work over time, it can be done is why I was so offended and frustrated by the work of the self-styled leaders in this particular California single-payer debate.
Okay, so this is how it's being portrayed by some on the left. David Sirota at International Business Times wrote, and I quote, State Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon helped his and his party's corporate donors block a Democrat-sponsored bill to create a universal health care program. Since 2012, Rendon has taken in more than $82,000 from business groups and healthcare corporations that are listed in state documents opposed to the measure. In the same time, the California Democratic Party has received more than $1.2 million from the specific groups opposing the bill. So he's portraying this as sold-out corporate Democrats protecting their donors' interests.
Right.
Who else is talking about it like in these terms?
Well, let me just start by saying that there are absolutely no heroes in this debate. Anthony Rendon, regardless of his personal views, is covering for a caucus that's incredibly moderate, despite having a two-thirds majority. This is a caucus that the same day that Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement, they voted down a bill to extend cap and trade. These ideas that I'm somehow a defender of Anthony Rendon aren't really true, but
on this specific case,
on this
right?
specific issue, you have to look at the big picture. Now, yes, we have the California Nurses Association putting up a picture of Anthony Rendon, you know, actually a bear with word Rendon on it, being stabbed in the back, to use old Weimar Germany imagery. You have die-ins happening at Anthony Rendon's office. You have Our Revolution coming out and the California Courage Campaign and all kinds of people coming out and expressing their fury at Anthony Rendon as if he's the only individual responsible for this, what is taking place with respect to single payer, and the idea that that one person is holding back the gates is what I reacted to.
Well, I've also heard, and we're about to get into the meat of that. I'm sorry to draw this out for listeners, but I've heard a number of people say that the only problem here is the cost of insuring everyone through a single payer, and they say it's dishonest to talk about the cost to taxpayers without noting that it would save all that money and more because it cuts down on administrative costs, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not the problem with this bill. It's not just a matter of the cost, right?
Right. I mean, I've made that argument. I mean, the argument you're saying is one I've actually made myself.
I have as well. When Bernie Sanders proposed it and the Wall Street Journal said it was this crazy tax hike.
Yeah, I've written stories about that, about how disingenuous that is.
Yes.
And you know, I tend to agree with the analyses that if you're talking about a large sum of money, you have to, the proper comparison is to relate that to what the cost of premiums are and care for everybody today. And when you make that comparison between what it would cost to do this single payer bill and what it already costs to manage and administrate the health system in California, those are comparable and in fact lower in the single payer.
It's cheaper and you cover everybody, right?
That's right.
So that's a straw man. Let's talk about the actual problems with this actual bill. And let's start with issues that are unique to California with its crazy tax measures and prop this and prop that. Right. Tell us about that.
I mean, this is the major problem in my view. I mean, there are others, but the major problem in my view is that for the last 40 years, we've had this dysfunctional system of managing the budget in California, which I've had the misfortune of seeing up close since I moved there in 2002. And we've papered over it with initiative after initiative. We have this addiction to direct democracy in the state. And it's created this straitjacket so that legislators can't get big things done. Now, I'll just point out the one main obstacle that I really dug into deeply in this piece. And it's a thing called Prop 98. So what is Prop 98? This was a thing that was passed in 1988. 10 years before that, we had this thing called Prop 13 that sharply lowered property tax rates, so that you couldn't increase property taxes at all, pretty much. And this was a serious blow to the budget and the California Teachers Association, because property taxes and school spending are typically interrelated, put this thing called Prop 98 on the ballot. And what it does is it creates a formula, a very hard and complex formula, so much so that literally one guy knew how to apply this formula, and he died 2 years ago. A crisis in California because no one actually knows how to use this formula.
Oh, God.
The formula in its general terms says that 40% of all general fund revenues must go to K through 12 education. And if you add K through 14, which would be community colleges, it's around 50%. Now, those fluctuate, but that's the general idea, that education has to get its fair share of funding out of the budget. A percentage of the budget must go to that. So just do the math. If you put the healthcare system on budget, even if it's cheaper for the individual, you would have to still maintain that Prop 98 formula where half of the budget goes to the education system, which essentially means that you would have to raise twice as much as you need in order to fund a single payer system.
That's crazy.
This is very peculiar to California. This doesn't mean that single payer can't work anywhere. This doesn't mean anything like that. It means that in California, we have this messed up system with our budget that makes anything but education spending a very heavy lift. Now, is there a way around that? There's not a way around it legislatively. The legislature by a two-thirds vote can suspend Prop 98, but they can only do it for 1 year, and they have to show that they will increase revenues in the future to get us back to the level they should have been when they made the suspension. which means that if you suspend this every year, pretty soon you're going to be saying, here's a 120% tax rate, which we're not going to do, but next year, you know, and that backfills it to the point that it should have been when you started massively suspending Prop 98. So that's not sustainable in a legal way, in a political way. Somebody would sue and say you're violating Prop 98, obviously. So legislatively, you can't do it. At the ballot, you can. And it's done routinely. You create special funds that are earmarked for a specific purpose, and then they're not part of the general fund. You can easily do that at the ballot. The legislature can even put that on the ballot. But you have to have the ballot. And by the way, Prop 98 isn't the only obstacle. It's not the only limitation in the state constitution to a system like they want to pass with this single payer bill. There's a thing called the GAN measure, which is a spending cap, essentially. The government can only spend a certain amount. And that was really kind of wiped out by a separate ballot measure. But when you put an entire healthcare system on the budget, suddenly the GAN limit would come back into play. So you would have to go to the ballot and say, we're changing the GAN limit, or healthcare doesn't apply to the GAN limit. So the point is that none of this is operative without a ballot measure.
Now, you say that that's the fatal flaw, but I mean, in a sense, there is another, I think, equally imposing barrier, which is that, you know, you hear people say, well, the Democrats have a two-thirds majority in, and Democrats obviously dominate the California government.
Right.
But in order to make a public, a single-payer public health care system, right, you need all of those federal dollars that are coming in from Medicare, from Medicaid, from Obamacare subsidies, from the state children's health insurance program, from veterans care, right? I mean, you need all of that money. Tell us what, right, how that would go about.
I mean, I alluded to this in the piece, but I did, you know, a bit less. But you're right. I mean, there is, and the real problem is this: there is a waiver process set up within the Affordable Care Act that says if a state shows that they're going to cover just as many people with their own system, that they can get a waiver from the federal government for all subsidies in Obamacare and for Medicaid. There's a way to do it for those two systems. And that's a large sum of money. Now, is the Trump administration going to offer that waiver? No, of course not. But, you know, over time, you know, maybe you get somebody in running on single payer in 2020 and they allow California to take the leap. The problem is that, number one, there is no federal mechanism for shifting Medicare to the states. It just doesn't exist. There's no way to do it right now that you can have the federal government give a waiver and give all the Medicare money that a state would be eligible for to the state to do their own single payer system. You can't do it. So not only would you need buy-in from the next president, you would need buy-in from Congress. There would have
to be
Congress to do that.
And by the way, let's note that this is this would create a model of single payer, and that's probably the last thing that this conservative Congress that's looking to gut public health care would ever want to see happen. Medicare, unlike those other programs that we talked about, is not a cost-sharing program between states and the federal government. It's run by the federal government. I imagine that there's no mechanism to transfer VA funds either. Is that true?
I'm not sure about the VA. What I do know, which is another major obstacle, is that there doesn't seem to be a way to transfer what California needs, which is the employer exclusion on health insurance purchases. You know, so when employers buy health insurance, they get a tax break from the federal
tax break, not a state tax break.
Not a state tax break. They get a tax break from the federal government for the cost. You know, it comes out of their business expenses. I don't know how you capture that money and give it to a state for single payer. And an even bigger issue is that self-insured companies and a lot of large employers don't actually contract with an insurance company. They insure their workers themselves. And that process is governed by a federal law. There's no way for a state to get involved in that process. This is under a thing called ERISA, the Retirement Income Security Act. And that would also require an act of Congress. The problem is there's not a good way at the state level to put everybody in one system. And the entire promise of single payer is that everybody's in one system. That's what brings the administrative costs down. That's what allows you to bargain for cheaper provider costs and cheaper prescription drug prices and all.
Right. The idea is you get this huge pool, and that gives you all sorts of negotiating power and cuts down on administrative costs, cuts down on duplicative systems, machines that go ping at various hospitals, et cetera, et cetera. So let me ask you this, David, what is this really about? You write in this piece that all of these folks, and I'm not going to include David Sirota in that because I don't know what he knows, but the people who are working on this in California, you said that they know about these issues. They know perfectly well that these things. So why do they want lawmakers to take a vote on a bill that's incomplete, that doesn't specify its funding mechanisms, that can't get the necessary congressional approval from D.C., when Republicans would no doubt, without any doubt, run ads against them saying, you know, Representative X voted for this huge tax increase? What is this about?
Yeah, I mean, nobody who spent more than 5 minutes in Sacramento knows all of these issues, that you have to go to the ballot, that you have to, that there are serious constraints on acquiring the federal funding for state use. There have been 7 different bills on single payer in California over the last 25 years. And most of them actually have more substance to them, at least on the delivery issues, on the governance issues, than this one does. It is very clear to me that this is a political effort to acquire glory from a certain segment of the progressive base that really wants to see single payer, that is looking at the Affordable Care Act and the rickety foundations of it, and thinks that next time we're not going to, you know, come up with some what is termed a half measure, and single payer is where we're going to go. And they're looking at California to be a leader, and they're sort of abusing this desire among the base by making it look much simpler than it is. And by singling out individuals when the problem is a problem of process, and by seriously over-promising what you can actually do and how long it can take. And that's what I detail in the piece. People aren't particularly happy with me for pointing this out, but that's the reality, is that if you are someone who really thinks that what is needed now is we need to move toward what every other country in the world practically has, which is some manner of universal health care, you should be mad that the leadership is in a destructive way minimizing the obstacles and putting out a narrative that this is as simple as one man allowing a vote in this state assembly. It's not that simple. Everyone should know there's a long road ahead. There's a coalition that needs to be built. There are millions upon millions upon millions of dollars that need to be raised for the inevitable and necessary ballot measure that will cost hundreds of millions, because you know the industry is going to line up against it, just like they did last year in California when Prop 61, which attempted to simply make state prescription drug purchases at the same cost as what the VA pays, the pharmaceutical industry spent $110 billion against it, and they won. They killed Prop 61, even though the exact same coalition on the left was all in favor of it. So clearly more work needs to be done here, not just with working through the obstacles, but in real coalition building. And I want to say that there are some elements in California who are doing that work at the grassroots level, one door knock at a time. And they're being ill-served by people at the top who are loudly using this for their own political purposes, to aggrandize power, to put the fear of God into legislators, and legislators, frankly, who are using this to, you know, as a springboard to higher office. Ricardo Lara and Tony Atkins are the two co-sponsors of the Senate version of this single-payer bill. Ricardo Lara wants to be insurance commissioner, a statewide elected position. Tony Atkins, who used to be the assembly speaker, wants to be the head of the state Senate. They're using the ardor that they're getting for being the champions of this bill that was just a shell. It creates it's no different than creating a feasibility study. I mean, if you read the actual bill, they just create a committee called the Healthy California Committee or something like that, that would answer all the questions of single payer, essentially. And they're using this in a cynical way to gain favor with the base. And so did the Senate President Pro Tem, who wants to run for higher office down the road, Kevin DeLeon. He kicked it to the assembly without answering any of the fundamental questions and saying, you deal with it. I'm going to get the love from the base and you're going to get the stabbed in the back imagery when you don't go forward with it.
David, let me ask you this. should we be making specific policies, these kinds of litmus tests, rather than starting with broad principles that I think everybody, or not everybody, but that a lot of people on the left embrace? For example, I identify as a single payer advocate, but in truth, I think that we should see essential health care as a human right and that the government should guarantee that everyone is covered. But I acknowledge that there are more than one ways to skin that cat. Mm-hmm. You know, the Dutch have an excellent healthcare system. It is in broad strokes somewhat similar to Obamacare, only that insurance companies are nonprofit entities, et cetera, et cetera. There are multiple ways to get to the same place.
Right.
And if you start from those principles rather than making a specific policy litmus test, then you can have a debate about the best way to achieve those goals without calling each other names, accusing people of selling out, et cetera, et cetera. Your thoughts on that?
Is the question of incrementalism versus you're asking a question of tactics and strategy. And it is true that when there are lives at stake, and we're having this discussion in the context of the Senate being, you know, very close to putting us several steps backwards on universal healthcare, on this goal that's out there on the horizon. And, you know, certainly focuses, you know, attention needs to be paid very specifically and urgently to that. So my point is that California is going through this process. California, in this era of Trump, has this status as sort of the harbinger of liberal America. You know, I mean, it has a 2/3 majority, has a Democratic, every statewide officer is Democratic. If you're going to have a debate that is over the horizon, as it were, it would have to be in California. The problem is the same state where you should be having that debate also has completely incinerated its political process through decades of stupid ballot measures and stupid constraints, and now is not in a position to be in that leadership role in certain cases.
You know what? It's really maddening. Here in New York, we have this independent Democratic caucus that basically gives the Senate control over to the Republicans. Right. And it seems like we have these solidly blue states that should be leading. They don't have the same kind of things going on in Texas or Kansas, right. And it's just, it's maddening. It really is maddening.
It absolutely,
and it's asymmetric, you know? It's like, you know, California has the nonpartisan districting. There was a report by the Associated Press, actually, this week that found that up to 22 seats, Republicans have as many as 22 extra seats, according to partisan gerrymandering. There's just...
Right.
There's an asymmetry here.
The big thing here is that there's this strategy on the part of the backers is that, well, we're going to make this a litmus test and they're going to put up or shut up. And if they go against single payer, we'll just primary them. Well, we don't have a normal primary system in California. We have this stupid top two primary system where in the primary election, you can vote for anybody, Democrat, Republican, or whatever, and then the top two vote getters move to the general election. This makes it extremely difficult to primary a bad Democrat, because inevitably, what happens is they go
you
to the
split
general
it up.
Election. It's dem on dem, and the Republicans and the independents in that district make the decision of who your legislator is. This is why the Assembly, by the way, is so, you know, not really down with these very liberal ideas, even though the state has a 2/3 liberal majority. You have this mod squad that's, you know, functionally similar to the independent Democratic caucus in New York, but they keep the D name, you know. Right. So, you know, the strategy is. You know, there's even that other, I didn't even mention that in the article, but there's that other constraint. Like, you can't run a primary strategy in California until you get rid of this stupid top two thing.
I mean, they need to deal with some serious democracy issues in California. And I know that the nonpartisan redistricting is a good idea in theory. It's just,
I would argue, like, what we had before nonpartisan redistricting was a corrupt bargain between Democrats and Republicans in the legislature to hold on to X amount of seats.
I mean, it's right. It's just
redistricting.
It's just unilateral, you know. Yeah. This is
nonpartisan redistricting included. It ended up benefiting the Democrats greatly.
Why didn't they make a deal with Texas to do the same thing? You know what I'm saying?
Well, there's obviously disproportionality there, but I mean, I think the larger point is that there's. And before you just jump headlong into these fights, you have to understand the landscape, and that those questions of what the realities are, then go back and inform your strategy. And maybe once you do that, your strategy still is that you push for this bill or whatever. It wouldn't be my strategy, but maybe that is your strategy at the end of the day. But be honest about it. Like, be honest about it and you know, actually assess what it would take and what the stakes are and communicate that to your supporters, because there's a lot of supporters out there that have no idea about this. And they're going to be pissed off if, let's say, their strategy worked and Rendon relents and somehow the Assembly signs it, and somehow Jerry Brown, who already said he would veto this, somehow signs it. Then you hear about this ballot measure thing and you're going to be pissed off.
Yes.
And that's the real problem, is that it's destructive to the overall goal. If you are a single payer supporter, you should be mad that the leadership has gone with this putting all their eggs in this one basket strategy.
I also think that, you know, these intra left fights are becoming increasingly tribal. Less about real ideological differences and more about, you know, who's on which team. It's very frustrating, and it's harder to work out those kinds of differences than legitimate differences about policy or strategy or tactics. When it becomes tribal, it's tribal, and everybody gets their back up, and it's just not helpful at all. David Dayan's piece is at The Intercept. That's theintercept.com, all one word. It's California single-payer organizers are deceiving their supporters. It's time to stop. David, I want to thank you so much for taking the time, and I used more time than I had asked you for. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, not at all. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank Heather Digby Parton. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show at iTunes or Podbean or SoundCloud or wherever else you can find it. I'd like to thank Heather again, as well as Smirking Chimp and the Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their prospective joints. You can write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. I will check that email account someday. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine, patriotic Americans for tuning in. Have a terrific week.